Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 6 continues. Imogene said, "I tell you what, you give me today and then my next regular day, Friday, to clear up my end of things and I'll be out." Muffy said, Actually, would be just as easy, we thought, to make a clean break. Kay has been working so closely with you, she can easily transition everything into her own hands. It was the modern way to let people go. Fewer downgrading, all at once, so the HR person need see those fired-looking expressions for only 1/2 hour. Besides, who cared about that or unfinished current projects? If those projects were attractive, the organization wouldn't be firing. It was the psychology of a planned downgrade. When you were planning an upgrade, you read the dropped employee as good riddance. If they looked licked, they had it coming, like Hitler getting rid of Rome's SA. Imogene had mistakenly majored in music at Oberlin because, at 17, she had respected her mother's values. But she had taken modern European history on the side. The Third Reich was like something out of Ecclesiastes. The United States was like something out of Ecclesiastes. Everywhere was like something out of Ecclesiastes. Now she thought of it. Kay said, "I've really enjoyed working with you, Imogene." "Oh, good," Imogene said. The other two still hung there, so Imogene thought, "Oh, yes, they need me to help them get out of what used to be in my office." Anyone could see that they would give 100 each not to be in this office one more minute. Besides, they will want to go to the volunteers' room and give the high sign to the women waiting in there that all had gone as planned. Imogene got to her feet. She smiled. "I am going to throw you guys out because I want to sort out my computer. And what about the dry dog food, you two?" Take it. Take that with you," Muffy explained. "We won't be needing it. And all those cans, too." "No more feeding dogs on the staircase, then," said Imogene. Now that Muffy saw Imogene's grin, she reseated herself, but only on the edge of her chair. She said, "Frankly, this whole thing about the dog food and the people on the staircase, Imogene, I wasn't going to mention that, but since you brought it up, that's a thing that has concerned me. And Rig, too. Rig, the husband." Muffy said, "Imogene, we are sick of those people squatting on our staircase, sick of their dogs, sick of having cans of dog food stacked up in the stock closet, so when we go in for high-brightness paper, we have to shove aside tin cans. Sick of it. I want to be up front about that. Another thing, Imogene, this place is just too much of a dump. I think you ask an awful lot of your volunteers, you know. I wonder if you realize how much. These people volunteer in a lot of other places. Who do you think races all over the damned Arrowhead region in the middle of winter at 20 below, not to mention on summer weekends instead of going to the lake, raising money for the orchestra and the playhouse and the library? These are hard workers, but no one except you expects them to work in such a..." "Well, for goodness sakes, Imogene, this place is just a dump. You know that as well as I do." She dwindled off. She had got to the door. Imogene was left to surmise just how Muffy and the other volunteers, or maybe all it took was Muffy and Rig, had co-opted Kay. She thought how she and Kay went back a ways. On the other hand, everybody goes back a ways. She and her ex-husband went back a ways. Hitler and Churchill went back a ways. She wondered what kind of money they meant to pay Kay to be executive director. They were business-minded. Jobs were scarce. They might well have decided they didn't have to offer Kay much at all, perhaps less than what they had paid Imogene Dendebray. Imogene carefully role-played Reagan Muffy. If she were Reagan Muffy, she would invite Kay for a martini, point out that early on in any organization you had to have muscle bound, No scruples, bad manners, people. True, Emma Jean had more or less stiffed a tough real estate team to get the lease for the Duluth Church basement at half what the owners had wanted to charge. Good enough at the time, Reagan Muffy would say, in a generous tone, giving credit. Emma Jean thought some more. She thought, if I were Reagan Muffy, I would tell Kay, we see you very big in our concept. Frankly, Kay, we don't want to see anyone with your potential slip-sliding down with the Emma Jean Tenebrae's of this world. Emma Jean copied her own letters and memos as well as she could onto her pre-flood floppies, the VFP budget never having sprung for decent electronics. At least she deleted from the computer itself everything she had copied. She left saved the volunteers' records and their primitive finance program. She opened and read over the document called Good Quotes Used Somewhere. She had made a beautiful default, an old English font that made everything look like Episcopal Church newsletter. She scrolled through a few quotes. There were a lot of wonderful people in the world, actually. She wasn't just being a wishful-thinking ass. It was true. Susan Sontag and Michael Moore and Michael Chu and Senator Robert Byrd and Edward R. Murrow. In that seraphy print face, Molly Ivins looked permanent, like Thomas Paine, someone to last. Someone knocked. Come in, cried Emma Jean, as much like a ray of sunlight as she could. Might be one of the homeless. They sometimes came in to explain their kid got a new puppy, and did Emma Jean have an extra of the dog food, canned, hay better than dry? She was going to fill one of those black hefties with all the remaining dog food, tell them to take it away. Hi, Emma Jean, said Kay. Hi, Kay, said Emma Jean, cordially enough because she still had a quote from Thomas Paine in her ears, and it still held her up. She did not say, how is every little darn thing with you since 2 minutes ago? Good, I hope. Instead, she said, come in, sit down. Kay said, I want to be very upfront with you about something, Emma Jean. Emma Jean waited. You know, the receptions we've had after some of the vigils and all. I wanted to tell you straight up front that a couple of weeks ago, I met a guy from your town, St. Fursey. I like him a lot, Emma Jean. So I just wanted to tell you that. I think we may be seeing each other. Emma Jean said, who's that? His name is Vern Denham, actually. I know you and he kind of know each other. In fact, he mentioned you, I mean. Emma Jean said aloud, I do know Vern. Nice guy, too. Kay stood up now smiling, looking relieved. Well, I thought it only right to let you know. You bet, Emma Jean said. The Mac's old hard-working after dark was now bannering across with, please wake up, please wake up, please wake up. In her car, Emma Jean was listening to the history of everywhere, thanks to the teaching company and the Duluth Public Library. She listened to one audiobook after another, going backward and forward in time. She had listened to the history of creatures on Earth before Homo breeze sapiens ever got erectus enough to be the cause of the fifth huge extinction. Emma Jean left Duluth listening to Ice Age times on the car audio. Soon the ponds and thousand-mile slows of one or another interglacial period were so vivid to her that her own species felt like happenstance. Clearly, easily, this globe would have got along without us. And maybe, she remarked to herself this noon, pushing in a CD about the huge Romford elephant found in the north of England, now being repaired in St. Louis, maybe our species will get wiped out too. She listened. She let the truthful science quiet her feelings. Gradually, her outrage settled out, became a new river floor of her mind. Mid-morning sun shone on what was left of last night's clean snow. It warmed the still green meadow grass that poked through it, so that in the fields that Emma Jean passed, whiskers of green rose everywhere, through the white. How valuable it all was. Then a strange thing happened. For the first time in the 4 years since her then-husband had sat, without moving, in a fishing boat, and somehow allowed his infant son to drown out overside, Imogene felt suffused with desire. Back then her father had cried, "Oh, you must forgive him. Emmy, you must, you must, you must. Oh, Imogene, forgive him." "I do," she had said. They were being returned home in a Cala funeral director's limousine. "Oh, she did, she did. She did forgive him," she told both parents. She sat motionless as cut flowers. Her father, even her mother, who was more or less sober at the time, had urged further. This could happen to anyone. The soul suddenly freezes, and then you are unable to save a life. "Yes, yes, of course," Imogene had said. "Oh, of course, she forgave him. Dad, Mom, believe me, I forgive him." The only trouble was she could not touch him again, ever again, not for any reason. Then, worse, after a year had passed, and he and she were formally separated, she discovered that she couldn't touch anyone. That is how it had been for 4 whole years. But now this, here in the car, a burst of pointless lust. It was the sight of the green grass that did it, coming up through the snow. Good God, she thought. She fought it off. She did not want a gratuitous aberration of the mind. Too late, her mind had begun to sing with lust. It was flying and slipping its song down upon her. It thought up possibilities. She tried to shut up her mind, but push had come to shove, and her mind went turncoat, betraying her will. It went over to her body's side, and deeply every minute her body kept hollowing and hollowing. Her mind said lyrically, "Look, why didn't you stop the car? Take most of the air out of one tire, open the trunk, pull clear the jack, the spare, the fore-end wrench, and the pad for kneeling." "Shut up," she told her mind. Her mind explained that she could stand there outside the front door without doing anything and carefully look into the faces of truck drivers coming northbound on 53. When one stopped, and her mind pointed out that someone might stop because she still wore her fairly okay work clothes, okay stockings, requisite USA black suit and khaki silk blouse, her only pair of boots with the classy clumpy heels, her mind said that what would happen is a guy would drop lightly down from a baby staircase of his semi-cab and amble back to her. Did she need help? She would explain that she did not want to tie him up or anyone else into a commitment of any kind, not even a one-night stand, that what we are talking here is a quarter hour or less to whatever he was up for. She meant only if they. Such a pickup would be the first for her, but Imogene was a social worker, so she expected to be patient as she moved through the communication stages. Surprise, amusement, not disdain, she hoped, though that was always possible. If he wore one of those outsized crosses that born-agains who were Republicans wore, then the whole plan was off. Of course. But it wasn't off. Then he would next, she expected, feel vanity and then delight, maybe. Then there would have to be a moment of practicality. It would be his semi, not her Civic, more room, then back to delight, she hoped, without jeering, she hoped, just pure delight. And afterwards she would tell him an admiring thing or two about how he was an absolute doll, and he would believe it, and drive off thinking about it, and so would she. "This is such a dumb idea," she told her mind, not only dumb, but gross, although she noticed that she had let the car slow all the way down to 40, as if to go off onto the shoulder and stop. Her mind wasn't through. It imagined another instance for her. An elongated limo with black glass windows would pass her. It would slow and stop and back up, one of those big cars that are so expensive they are as quiet in reverse as they are in drive. Looked like a serious car full of criminals. She imagined they were stopping to murder her as she stood there, so she lifted the wrench and kept hold of it. She wasn't going down without a fight. The driver got out. He did not wear the downscale tucks of limo drivers and musicians who must have black tie before they can afford it. No mafia camel's hair overcoat. He was beautifully dressed. He approached her briskly. His face was poker grave. "I will escort you to the limousine," he said. "The president has asked me to tell you he is at your service." Oh, give me a break, Imogene said to her mind. Would you please give me a break? Besides, since you brought it up, not this president. Her mind didn't care. It was getting off in its own little chemoelectric fires flaring all across the cortex. At last, Imogene drove along with only a philosophical problem. If desire was now coming back to her after these 4 years, did that mean she would come out of her cocoon of hard work and away from her hundreds of nightmares about that little boy whose name she still could not say aloud? And had she enough poise left in her heart to enter the world of men again? She thought of Vern Denham. In fact, he had come to her parents' house for dinner just a week ago, as now she recalled. Her mind reminded her of how he had stood without leaning on anything in the little anteroom with its entire wall full of bookshelves. Men with all that musculature and their readiness to move quickly. They had that. The good ones had muscle and they moved fast. Men were most interesting looking when you saw them in places of culture. That is, there's nothing much engaging in the muscle of someone digging a ditch or strangling somebody. But when males stood with a baton or in front of a whole wall of books, then you felt two things at once. The man's muscle, of course, but also the private power hidden in any human cranium. Inside yourself lurches the pole between those two, mindless body and the brain with its genius for constraint. If either wins, the man is ruined, and you with him. But if both are there, he might be okay. She might be okay. Imogene went over it to herself, but after a few minutes she was really paying no attention. Really what she was doing was visiting old sights in her mind. The way you stop here and there when you visit an old hometown. You don't start some intelligent quarrel with those who greet you at their doors. You simply ask them, "How is everybody? After all this time, how are you? And you, actually, how are you all?" Chapter 7. Whoever said the meek shall inherit the earth didn't know anything about being on the bottom of the system in your own hometown. And another thing Brad Strop was sure of, those ancient people like Jesus got to live outdoors all the time, keeping sheep from falling into hot sandy ravines and kicking back with strangers at wells and saying wise things which people actually stayed to hear. Nothing was like that now, and people weren't like that now. Brad Strop may not have gotten much out of church when he was a kid, but he remembered about the sheep, which they let you color in Sunday school, and the hot sand and grass. And those shepherds weren't just out to shove other people around. Judas was not like St. Fursey with its 1,000-plus people whose shit list never changed. No matter how true some insight you told someone, if it was something they'd never heard before, they jeered at you. You tell your boss something they really don't want to hear, they fire you. A few days ago, he was fired from Marty Hank's Super Value. Today, Brad had something a lot better going. He told Arlene at 5 in the morning, when she was already spreading out her sweepstakes paperwork, "I need the car today. You'll have to walk today. Who do you clean for today, anyway?" She already had her nose moving along close over the spread-out sweepstakes sheets. Arlene looked more like a bear following a scent than a person reading. "Anyway, you'll have to walk," he said. "How come?" she said. "I'm going to apply to Garris Autos for a job, and I can't arrive there on foot like some hitchhiker." Now she looked up all right. "Hey," she said, but not in a mean way, "what happened to the job at the Super Value?" Brad said, "We parted ways, Hanks and I did." "You'd have to say we parted ways." Her jaw hung open. She regarded him in that slack way she had. He said, "There's a time for people to work together, and there's a time to part ways. I decided not to stall around, just cut it off clean." Truth was, all the time he was working at Marty's Super Value, he had already been making roundabout inquiries about Garris Autos. Marty's after-school help, the doctor's kid, knew a lot about the car lot. Marty himself worked with the experienced guys in meat and frozen. Brad got to know Simon Anderson because he was the latest hire. He and Simon were often relegated to the huge, lonely warehouse together. They talked steadily as they sliced cartons with the box cutters. Then all the dry line, canned and boxed, for the center aisles would go to the other end. In staff meetings, people feel fairly equal, but when you are box cutting with a 16-year-old, you know you are at the bottom. What Brad and Simon saw in their imaginations was not the dreary warehouse, but new cars and the people who sold new cars or serviced recent models. Simon knew about cars and dealerships the way some boys know about F-16s. Simon told Brad that no one could ever get that job of gopher at Garris Motors in town because Garris's gopher was old George Herzlich, who was top salesman and gopher both, all sewed up. Mr. Herzlich did all the driving when dealers traded models. If someone in St. Fursey wanted a new car from Garris's inventory, but the one in the showroom was the wrong color, Garris would call up the GM guy in Hibbing, or Chisholm, or Cook, or even all the way down to Duluth. If the other dealer had it on inventory, they traded. George Herzlich looked more like a diplomat than a half-retired car salesman now doing odd jobs around the lot. He would go pick up the car. For actual deliveries, Simon told Brad, George Herzlich's old lady would go along. People would see them out on the road in the shiny new car, him wearing shirt and tie, and Garris uniform sport jacket, her knitting. More and more, Brad realized that his own skills would be recognized, not here at the dumb super value, but at Garris's dealership. Brad dropped a jar of Miracle Whip onto the concrete floor where it made a serious crunch. Its white, custardy glob full of shards spread itself out a little, but Brad managed to etch it more or less together with the side of his tennis shoe, then shove it under the warehouse racking. Then the owner, Marty Hanks, came up silently from behind him. Marty might have been there for the last 5 minutes for all Brad knew. There's a type of people who sneak up on you. They just are that way. Marty bent over, scraped the half-smashed jar and glop back out into a dustpan, took it over to the nearest waste bin. He gave Brad a nod and passed on. He could have smiled, but he didn't, because he owned the place, and he liked to make you feel bad. The kid kept talking about new GM cars. He gave a laugh. Well, I can't afford anything except a junker myself, but I sure would like one. Brad thought, how come he didn't have some okay car? He's the doctor's kid. Yet, maybe that doctor wasn't much of a doctor either, since he practiced in their dumb town, St. Fursey, and drove only a Garris Auto Chevrolet, too. Brad and the kid finished cutting all the freight and stacking it by aisles, ready to move to the floor. Brad imagined himself working for Garris, gradually rising to the sales department. Then something might happen to Garris. That was not a dumb idea, because things happen to people. And Garris's wife would come up to Brad and tell him that he was the only person around the lot who seemed to know the business. And would he take it over? Brad's wife, no, she wasn't anyone who helped a man get ahead. It wasn't that Arlene had got fat or was an alcoholic or pretended to be sleepy. It was that she somehow was like a pile of human parts instead of a real person. Last week, a lot of bad stuff happened more or less all at once. Brad was out down towards Small Bass Lake and got his foot busted off in a conibear bear trap. Then he got fined for shooting a bear cub. Then the chief of police took one of his guns away. Then there was that dead girl. Then Marty Hanks fired him from the grocery store. About the only thing he wasn't worried about was that Stan Garris had decked him at the VFW on Friday night. Brad knew Stan was very drunk and wouldn't remember. On the day he got fired, Marty had said, Simon, when you and Brad get through out here, pile up all that Charmin toilet tissue cartons, put the cloth over it for the staff meeting, and pull the chairs around. Okay, Simon said. Brad tapped his cutter back into its sleeve. He liked that Marty told that kid, not him, to set up for the staff meetings. Even if Simon had been there longer, the fact was Brad was 48, not 16. What you got with Brad was an older person's judgment, for one thing. That's got to be worth something, even in the dumbass grocery business. but he hated staff meetings. They were always at 11 and 4 p.m., so half the employees went to each meeting and the other half covered the store. Marty would send the meeting half out into the deli to choose what they wanted to eat, one pop of their choice. Marty ran the meetings from notes in front of him. He said in a loud voice he wanted to thank the checkouts and the baggers for not having jokes among themselves when customers were going through. "Makes us a friendly store," he repeated for the thousandth time. "Look, next time you go to Duluth," he told them, "go get some groceries. Don't get too many, hey? Remember, you're supposed to shop here." Everyone dutifully grinned. "But go in and see how the checkout and the carryout treat the customer." Then Marty brought up some other items and finally said that was it. Brad got up. "Stick around, Brad." When the others had picked up their aprons and gone out front, Marty said, "Have a seat a second." Marty paused. "I'm not going to beat around the bush. I have to let you go, Brad. The town's not growing, let's face it. What mining they're still doing at the other end of the Mahoney, that taconite and all. If they're making money at all, it doesn't rub off on us. Business is smaller. Not down, but smaller. I can't use as many people." "You just took on somebody last week," Brad said. "And anyway, I sure as hell have seniority over that Anderson kid." Marty didn't look upset. "That's right, Brad. But I have to look at everything. He's a good worker. I'm a businessman. I look at that." Brad felt shrunk, but he knew enough not to show it. "He's a dumb kid, if you want to know." Marty now looked even more relaxed. He leaned back against the Charmin tissue stack. His voice was almost cordial. He said, "Okay, Brad, I'll show you what I mean. What was last week's special in the deli promotion?" "That's not my job to know that stuff," Brad said promptly. "That's everybody's job," Marty said. "That's why we have it at staff meetings. What's Minnesota Lottery's new scratch-off this week?" Brad said, "Who'd ask me? I don't have anything to do with the customers. I do the heavy moving. I do the real work around this place. You hire someone to chew the fat with customers, or you hire someone to get the work done." Marty then said, "One more thing. You were supposed to take Bridget Garris's groceries and meal replacements up to her last Friday. She asked you if she could get things brought up from the deli for Saturday because she was having friends over." Brad grinned. "Her and all those old biddies in that building." Marty said, "You told her you didn't know if she could order deli delivered. You didn't bother to find out. You didn't come back and tell me to call her up and see what she needed. She and her friends have supper parties nearly every weekend, one night or another, usually Fridays. This one happened to be Saturday. That's 52 plus or minus deli orders sent up there a year. That's $500 or $600 business in a year. And when they come into this store," Brad said, "them go any place hobbling around with them walker cages." Marty said, "When they come in here, hobbling or not, they come hobbling into this store instead of getting their relatives to drive them to a Walmart. And so do their relatives. And anyway, Bridget Garris doesn't hobble."
You've been listening to Episode 8 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the Programs drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half.